Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast. This is A.L. Levy. You all should know who my guest today is. It's Mr. Dave Davidson. He's been on the podcast before, and his band Revocation is just crushing it right now. Their new album just came out on September 9th. It's called Nether Heaven via Metal Blade, and they just started a North American tour with Christian, Alluvial, and Inoculation, and that goes till October 16th. And then also next year, 2023, they're doing a European headline tour with Goat Whore, Alluvial, Creeping Death from January 19th to February 18th. All right, let's get into it. Dave Davidson, welcome back to the Riff Hard Podcast.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Man, lots been happening lately. It seems like you're in a very different situation now than last time you came on.
Yeah, I think everyone is kind of, right? I mean,
Well, specifically you and Revocation, seems like you guys got like a steroid injection sometime this year, like starting with that tour.
Yeah, that Cannibal tour with Whitechapel and Shadow of Intent, it was just a home run. I think there was like 25 out of 29 shows sold out. And we were playing like big rooms too. So that was great to go out there after being sidelined for so long and play in front of such huge crowds. And they were also just so like voracious. Like they just wanted to go out there, get in the pit, headbang, make noise, pick up merch. Like fans were just, I think, so excited to come back. So I definitely feel like we made some new fans on that tour for sure, because there was just so many people out there. You know, Cannibal brings people out of the woodwork. They've been around for so long, and they happen to put out like a great record in the pandemic that they didn't get a chance to tour on. So all of that kind of led up to this perfect storm where we were kind of thinking we were going to just be kind of done with the Outer Ones tour cycle. So I think that injected some new life into a record that had been out for a few years. So we got a little bit more juice out of that orange, which was nice. And then, yeah, ever since we started dropping singles for the new record, the heat's really been on. I feel like this is the most attention the band's ever gotten, which is a good thing. I mean, every record we put out, I feel like...
I think so, too.
Yeah, every record we put out, we go up a few rungs on the ladder, which is nice, but I feel like on this one, we kind of like had like a leap up to the next level, which was pretty cool. And the record's still not even out yet. I mean, we have, you know, I think 2 weeks till the release. I'm not sure when this podcast is going to come out, but the record comes out on the 9th of September, and then we do like a full US and Canada tour, and then we still have other stuff like planned out into 2023. So yeah, this is like a lot of things happening for the band right now, which is great, and it's just an exciting time for, you know, all around.
The trajectory that you've been following, I think, is more the norm for extreme metal bands. I know everyone wants things to happen quickly, but I actually think that the way that it's working for you guys right now is kind of the way it works for most bands that do well in extreme metal. They have to put out lots of music for a long time before it's not that the gatekeepers have to let them in, but before like the wider extreme metal audience accepts them, I think, or gives them a chance or lets them in. I don't know what it is, but I feel like that's kind of the most common trajectory for bands that do well in this style. That to make it past the great filter of not breaking up.
Yeah, it feels very organic. It feels very natural. We certainly aren't a flavor of the month band, that's for sure. So it's good to know that.
Which is great.
Yeah, it's good to know that the fans that we've made in the early days are still sticking with us. Yeah, now I think the floodgates are kind of open, and because we've sort of established ourselves in the underground, you know, in like different scenes, right? I mean, I think we kind of have some appeal to thrash bands. We have some appeal to death metal fans. We have some appeal to progressive metal fans. So we kind of hit a bunch of different subgenres. And I think we've kind of built up our fan bases in each one of those subgenres in different ways. I mean, we've toured with classic thrash bands like Forbidden, right? We've toured with death metal icons like Cannibal Corpse. We've toured with progressive metal acts like Periphery and Animals as Leaders. So yeah, like doing all those different tours, like you said, continuing to kind of put out music and just sticking around. You know, I think that's a big part of it, is like people kind of need to be reminded, I think, several times, at least some people, right? I mean, people that maybe aren't as hungry for underground music as maybe I was as a kid. I mean, for me, it was like I was trying to find like every single underground band.
You would be classified under the early adopter type
right.
of person. Me too, right? Like that's, I think, but that's not everybody. Mm. That's not most people.
Right. I mean, for some people, they need to literally see the band name, you know, 20 times before they finally click on it and say, okay, I'm going to check this out. But I think there's no substitute for live too. I mean, playing a show, let's say we're doing a support slot. So for that 30 to 35 minutes that we're on stage, it's like, you literally can't escape us, right? So like we're kind of confronting you with the music. And I think that's sort of the best way to win over fans, because when you're just even people that might, you know, click the link and check out a song that have never heard us before, they're home or maybe they're on the train or maybe they're in their car, they're distracted, they're thinking about 10 other things, it wound up in a playlist with 50 other bands on it, right? So like it's hard even to capture people's attention nowadays to listen to a song all the way through, just because there's so much stimuli, right, that we're kind of constantly being inputted with. So I think the fact that like a live show, just the volume, the intensity, the crowd. I mean, we're social creatures too, right? You know, if you see a bunch of people, you see a circle pit break out, like even if you're not in it, you feel that residual energy. And I think it just kind of like hypes you up. So I've always found like a great tour is, I think, one of the best ways to make new fans. But certainly all the hype around a record doesn't hurt, right? You need to get music videos and you've got different bits of press, you know, things like that, they do help, because especially with some of like the cool press, whether it's like a podcast like this, or it's more conversational, or, you know, just sort of like a random thing that, like, you know, I think about, like, I don't know, like Corpse Grinder and Target or something, right? You know, it was just such like a great like bit of like viral yep. content that, like, even if you weren't a fan of death metal, like, it's just like fun to watch, and like you see this like other side of, like, you know, someone that's very like brutal and yeah. like, you know, it's like,
well, you know, you have their persona, so anything that contrasts that
right
is pretty cool, or can be. Just out of curiosity, during the pandemic, do you feel like the band grew because you weren't playing live?
Yeah, I think we did in a little bit, or at least like I don't feel like our popularity like waned. I feel like we were able to kind of at the very least kind of hold people's attention and keep people yep. like engaged. Like I was doing those Slay at Home things. So, like, even though that's not directly involved with Revocation, I feel like things that my name is attached to, like,
it helps.
People are naturally going to, like, maybe associate that with Revocation in some way. So it kind of keeps us in the conversation, even if it's not something like Revocation specific. And then, like, you know, we released cool t-shirt designs, like different things for charity. We did like Halloween masks through our Night Shift merch store. Just like kind of little things, but like it gets people talking. It's not new music, but it makes people go like, oh, Revocation's doing a Halloween mask. Like, check that out. And then people kind of talk about it for a little bit. It doesn't have, you know, obviously like the staying power that releasing like a full length does, but it keeps the momentum going a little bit. It keeps the ball rolling. And even with that tour, I mean, the tour, the benefits of a tour are obviously the show, but there is another component to that, which is like, you know, you're on the flyer, like every single band on the tour is promoting the tour at least probably 2 months leading up to the tour actually taking off. So just being on a flyer with a band like Cannibal Corpse and Cannibal Corpse like sending that out to their followers, I can't say that like every single person that saw that flyer is like, oh, who's Revocation? I'm gonna check that out. But probably at least some percentage of people must have looked up the band just because of the flyer alone. Like, oh, should I get there? Should I try to get off work early, or should I just get there in time for, you know, the last two bands or whatever? So that also helps.
It's one more element of keeping you top of mind. I think that's what's really important. There's so many opportunities for you to be forgotten these days. And maybe not because people want to forget, just because there's so much shit going on coming at them. It's been like that for several years now. So I think anything you can do to stay top of mind in a positive way is good. And association with bands like Cannibal Corpse can't hurt. Obviously, not everyone's going to be into what you do. It's always going to be some smaller percentage than the headliner, but so what? It's all about little by little, I think. And I do think that keeping things top of mind makes a huge difference, because even for me, I consider myself to be an early adopter of cool music. Still, how many times did I have to get told that Arc Spire's sick by Dave Otero before I listened to him, and or Leprous or whatever? Like, I had to be told several times. It just happens. I think most people, they need to be told about it, then they need to see it online somewhere, then maybe it's on a tour flyer, maybe it's like on a playlist, someone else mentions it, and like you see this name like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times, then you might check it out. So it's really important, I think. And also, someone checked it out and thought it was cool, but like was on the train, like you said, or distracted. Staying top of mind after they've had one positive experience is what might lead them to check you out again, and then check you out again, and little by little turn themselves into a fan. So super important.
Oh yeah. It takes time, but we're playing the long game.
You have to. That's the cool thing about metal, though. There's no like age limit on it, and the genre doesn't seem to be going anywhere, as opposed to other types of genres. Sometimes if you're trendier, you might have greater chance of acute success, but long term is a lot tougher. That's the really cool thing about metal, I think. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, is that it is set up for long term and long play. And yeah, you have some bands like Slipknot that were like pretty massive almost out the gate, but that's not the norm. But the norm is that like good bands can stick around as long as they want to, basically. Like, you never really age out. So the long game is the way, I think.
Sometimes bands, yeah, they get super big, super quick, and it's like, you know, you take the escalator on the way up and then the elevator on the way down kind of thing. So sometimes, yeah, you can see that steep drop off because something, yeah, it was just a trendy thing, or they put out a song that went viral, but it was just kind of a fluke. And then it's like, all right, can you follow that up, though? Like, do you have more to say than just that one song or that one wacky, zany music video that you did that caught everyone's attention, and then people are on to the next thing?
That was a nice way to put it, elevator on the way down. I was thinking, like, the laundry chute with how fast I've seen it go away.
I guess, yeah, maybe faster than an elevator. Yeah, it can drop like a stone sometimes. But, I feel fortunate that we've got such a great fan base that we slowly built over time, and we're forging something in the fire, right? Like every time it gets like, every time you hit that anvil with that hammer, like that steel gets stronger. So I feel like with every single record that comes out, we're getting more focused, more dialed in. Just everything's just become more razor sharp. I think even in our material, like we still definitely try to expand our horizons with every release, but I think we still experiment, but we experiment in a more focused way, if that makes any sense. So, you know, I think in the beginning we were doing lots of different things, bringing in, you know, different elements constantly to our music, and maybe it didn't have, maybe for some people those are their favorite records, right? So that's the cool thing about music and being a fan too, is like someone might go back and say, oh, that's my favorite record, where it might not be my favorite. For me now, I think because we've been around for so long, it's kind of fun. Like writing a record now is like, we have so much like previous material that we've worked on over the years. So like having written so many songs at this point, I mean, I've written almost like 90 songs for this band. Like I really kind of feel like now more than ever, I've got like the idea of like what exactly I want Revocation to sound like. I'm still writing in a similar way. I'm still letting ideas just kind of like hit me, but I feel like we've really kind of defined our own sound, which feels great. Whereas like on previous records, I think we were like kind of working on that definition, and now I feel like it's defined, but it's weird. I don't feel like limited or confined in any way. I feel like actually like a great sense of like artistic freedom. Sometimes when you put a certain parameter on something, and it kind of forces you to think about it in a certain way, which then leads to new creative avenues. So I think, oh yeah, over the years, we've just gotten better at kind of defining what the Revocation sound is, and I couldn't be happier with where we're at now.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about this the other day. I actually was curious, so I looked in my BMI account. I was like, how many songs do I have under my belt with Doth, like, and associated shit? And it was somewhere around 70. And for some reason in my head, I thought it was like 30. I don't know why. And I was like, that's a good number of songs. I was thinking about it because of what you just said. Or in the earlier days, when I was also like 20 or 22 or 23, I was bringing in way more elements, like electronic this, like some like weird Latin music, like just all kinds of different things. And they were all through my filter. But right now I'm way more focused. Like I know exactly what the sound is, regardless of the break. And I think it is because of years of experimenting and then years of refining and years of thinking about it. But I think that there's a way to experiment and stay just as creative, however, being more focused once you know exactly what it is that the thing is. I think that's important when in the early stages, you don't quite totally know what it is yet. You have ideas for what it should be, but you don't totally know what it is. And I think that once you have written enough songs and created enough stuff, your idea for what it is, it's just far more developed. That's really it. I don't think you're like less like brave of an artist or anything. Less ADD, maybe. That's how I feel about it, is less ADD.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if you think about it in very logical terms, like when you're younger, you're experiencing a lot of music for the first time.
Yes, exactly.
And as a creative person, as an artist, like, I don't know about you, but when I'm hearing something, my gears just kind of naturally start turning of like, oh, like, how can I, whether it's conscious or unconscious, that thing is going to like influence me. Like, so yeah, oh, cool. Like, yep. What if I incorporated some Latin style rhythms into death metal or something exactly. like that, right? Like, oh, like this shit's really cool. I've never like heard rhythms like that. And then they just kind of naturally start to come in. And then you want to try to make it work. Like, I don't know about for you, and I've said this in interviews before, but writing a song for me is kind of like solving like a Rubik's Cube or something like that, some type of puzzle. Like, I kind of obsess over it and just keep moving pieces around until I can make the song fit in my head, until I can make the parts flow.
Yes.
Sometimes, like, you know, as a kid growing up, like an influence, wherever it's coming from, it's almost like a challenge, right? Like, I was like, oh, how can I make this work? I gotta make this work. I gotta be able to take something that like shouldn't fit into, you know, a quote unquote like traditional like death metal or thrash metal song and do something to it to like make it fit with that mm-hmm. flavor. And people have asked me too in interviews, like, oh, do you ever like regret any, maybe they didn't use the word regret, but yeah, like kind of like, yeah, are there any songs in your catalog that you look back on and, you know, yeah, like aren't as stoked on or.
Yeah, I can say yes for me. But
oh, well, but for me, it's like, but I don't regret writing any of it because it's like, okay. I had to get it out, you know, like it had to make those riffs that were in my head that I was wrestling over and trying to make fit and you know, craft a song out of, it's like, it's almost like you have these like just sort of blockades of artistic things that need to come out. And then that way that can make room for new stuff to come through. Right. So without getting it out of there, like if you just kind of lock it in your head, maybe I'd still be thinking about some song that, you know, never was. Right. I'm glad that I was able to write it
yep.
and put it out there. And then that, like, I can clear that off my plate now, and now I can move on to new music. And, you know, who knows, by putting out certain songs, you know, I might look back on it and be like, I definitely wouldn't write that style of song now. I'm happy that I did them because maybe it just got me to that next new thing that much quicker, right? And now having put out all these different songs, I can be maybe a little bit more selective, or like I said, I have a much better definition of what the Revocation sound is. So I'm still experimenting, but in different ways. I think, you know, in those early stages when you just have so much material, it's perfectly natural to explore different avenues, put out maybe records that
yeah.
have different feels or have a kind of wide swath of different influences on one record. I mean, I called Chaos of Forms that title like for a reason, right? There was so many different, it felt like, I even back then I could feel like, oh, we're really experimenting on this record with like lots of different texture. I mean, there's a fucking horn section and like Hammond organ solo on that album, and like there's like weird erratic thrash songs and like technical, super technical death metal parts, and even shit that almost has like a post-hardcore feel to like my ear on certain sections. So
mm-hmm.
just all of those different elements were obviously just sort of sloshing around in the creative juices of my mind. So Getting those ideas out, experimenting with different stuff early on, is a very natural, byproduct of just being a creative individual.
Regret is a strong word. Not being stoked on certain songs is one thing. And also maybe being like, I wouldn't release that song if I had to go redo it. That's another thing. But regret for writing it, why would you regret writing anything? You're not going to get to where you are without having done what you've done. There's no other way it could have happened. So I would regret nothing musically. How do you say this without sounding like you're less interested in music? That's what I've been thinking. So when I started the band, I had just gotten out of Berkeley. So I was just around all different kinds of shit. A lot of it I didn't like, some of it I did, but you can't be not influenced by the stuff you're around. So of course my musical output was going to be way more all over the place because I was just in an environment that was way more all over the place. I've kind of refined what it is that I think is good in music. There's that too. Even though it's developed, I don't listen to the same music I did 25 years ago now. I know some people will listen to only the stuff they were listening to when they went to high school forever. That's not me at all. But my standards for what I think makes a good song has definitely narrowed and refined itself. What I think is catchy, what I think is a quality idea, what I think is worthy of making it to a song has definitely narrowed, but not in a closed-minded sort of way. I just think my filter for what is acceptable has gone, the threshold's gone up, basically. There's more stuff that now, if I was experimenting with it and it didn't sound appropriate for a song, save it for something else, as opposed to try to get every single idea into a song. I think that's the big difference. Sounds like that's kind of what's happening with you too.
Yeah, sometimes you need to know when to walk away from a part too, or at least put it on the back burner, right? Just because you've got a riff, maybe you just aren't inspired to put other riffs with that, or nothing's coming, right? So rather than, take this riff that might be really cool and you can't fit it with anything, so you end up writing you're not happy with the stuff that you're putting around it, rather than release something that you're not totally stoked on, just to be I like this one idea. There's no harm in saving things, coming back, circling back. If anything, that shows that the riff is actually awesome, because if it holds up, if it stands the test of time, we can all be stoked on stuff that we're writing for the first time, in that moment, right? Something just comes out and you're like, oh, that's cool. But it doesn't necessarily have to live forever on a recording. It could just be something that's floating in the ether and it's just a riff that came out during a jam and it's just for you. And that's the cool thing about music too. And then that just kind of evaporates into the ether. Who knows where that idea goes, right? But in other times, if it's something that's worth keeping, I'll record it either in a DAW or I'll just record it in my phone. And I might have no intention of even turning that into any idea until way down the line. And it might not even make it on the next record. Who knows? Maybe I wrote 10 other songs for the record and that one riff that I love just never found its proper home. Just file it away and come back when it comes time to write the next record. And maybe then something will click. Maybe you'll revisit something having not heard it for a year. And all of a sudden, just hearing it sort of with new ears, a year later, boom, that's when other ideas start flowing out. And what was maybe a very laborious process trying to kind of fit this square peg into a round hole, all of a sudden is idea after idea after idea after idea. And you end up writing a whole song in an afternoon or something like that based off of this one riff that was giving you so much trouble. Sometimes shit just has to marinate. And it just takes a minute for certain ideas to sort of embed themselves into your artistic subconscious enough where other things can kind of come out. Sometimes you get lucky and you write three great banging riffs right off the bat. You're just in a session and maybe you're not even thinking about writing. That to me, I think is sometimes when I write my best stuff, where I'm not I'm going to sit down for a writing session right now. I'm just playing guitar in between lessons or something like that. Sometimes a riff will come out while I'm teaching. I'll be talking to a student about an idea or something like that, some particular concept. My gears are maybe turning in a different way, thinking about explaining a scale to someone. Or maybe it's a scale I've explained 100 times, but I'm trying to mix it up this time around and use some different analogies or just try to think about it in a different way that's still useful for the student, but keeps it fun for me. All of a sudden now through this different lens of teaching, I'm having to force myself to think about this scale in a different way. And then boom, a new idea comes out just like that, right? And then I got to tell the student, you know, don't take that. I'm going to sue you. No, I'm just kidding.
That's why sometimes it's harder to write when you sit down to write, is because the gears aren't activated. And that's why also I think when you sit down to write, if you're having shitty ideas or a rough time, it's important to just keep going, because it just means that the light bulb hasn't turned on yet. And I think one of the reasons that you can sit on the couch or be in a lesson or not thinking about writing and write the coolest shit is because the light bulb is on. That's all it is, in my opinion. So the trick is just to figure out how to turn the light bulb on when actually sitting down to write. Easier said than done sometimes. But speaking of old ideas, one thing I did do was I transcribed some of the early demos, like shit nobody's ever heard. Stuff from like 1999 or 2002. Like, I transcribed all of them because it's been a while, right? So I wanted to make sure that the new stuff I wrote had the DNA of the project. So I transcribed all the old material, and I was thinking, some of these riffs are so sick and it pisses me off that nothing ever happened with them. So I put some 20-year-old riffs that kind of just always bothered me that they never got used into some of the material that's about to come out. And that's just kind of the what you just said, that if it holds up over time, that means it's that's got to mean something. If there's a riff that I wrote 20 years ago that I still think is cool, and it still pisses me off that it never made it onto a record or into a song, should probably do something with it.
You're like fucking aging riffs like wine, like in a cellar somewhere.
Seriously, there's some cool ones.
You get like a 99 like Bordeaux riff.
Dude, there are, I'm serious. There's, in the first single we're putting out, there's this dual solo section right before this whole Baroque crazy shit. But right after the dual solos, there's this riff that comes in that is literally from 1999, but it's perfect right there. So
that's sick. Yeah. Now you know it. You know it's good if it's been around for that long and you still think it's cool.
Or I'm delusional.
Right. Well, that's why sometimes you just got to get those riffs out.
That's another question I have for you, is how do you know when something is good that you're working on? Because like you said, we all can think that something is good while we're working on it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like you're high on your own
supply.
Shit. Yeah. Basically, it's a very similar feeling. What is it about something that makes you think, yeah, this is good enough for Revocation, going to pursue this one?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's incredibly hard to answer, I think, because I know. It's just one of those things where, like, when you just know, you know. I don't know. It's got to hit me in a certain way. It's got to catch my ear. It's got to make me feel something emotionally, right? Whether it's a feeling of like, all right, this is just like ferocious and super aggressive sounding, or if it's something like, oh, this is cool, it's like a really epic kind of section, but it has like a melancholic feeling to it, which I kind of like. There's it's like epic but sad. I like to try to, like, sometimes with my riffs, like if they can touch on like a couple different emotions at once, I mean, that to me is incredible. I mean, I think all great art, whether it's visual art, you know, music, like anything in that art realm, like it can, if it's something that can express either like a really true form of an emotion, right? Like just like distilled anguish, right? Like sometimes I'll like listen to like Alice in Chains and it just like pulls on my heartstrings. It's just so like so much emotion to it. And like you feel like you're just like brought to the depths of this, like, you know, 90s grunge.
It's so real.
Like, so real. Like, you can just feel it, like haunting. And then sometimes, yeah, shit, like, hits on a couple different emotions where it's like, oh, this riff is like, yeah, like, it's triumphant, but it's, like, sad and triumphant. Like, it's weird. It's like, you won the battle, but
all your friends are dead.
Right, exactly. And then sometimes shit is just, like, an expression of the ineffable. And that's super cool. It's like, ooh, like, I don't even know what emotion this is making me feel right now, but I can feel like all the hair on the back of my neck raise up. You know, I get like goosebumps, and it's like you don't even like know where that's coming from. It's just, it's like, you know, looking at a piece of like incredibly like abstract art, right? Like where you're like, okay, this could kind of, it's almost like a Rorschach test, right? It can kind of be anything that you like want it to be. If you look at like, you know, like, I don't know, like a Kandinsky painting or something like that, like it's oftentimes just like not about anything. And it really is like, it's sort of more about like the artist's like subconscious process on a canvas. And anyone that views that painting might have a different takeaway from it. So I think that's another really cool element of music. And I think death metal does a really great job of that, right? Like tackling crazy cosmic concepts, right? That like are beyond the realms of like human perception. I mean, there's so many death metal bands that like to kind of discuss those topics in their lyrics or try to, you know, create riffage that has that kind of otherworldly, ineffable vibe. I think it happens all the time in like classical music as well. Certainly in jazz, like, you know, depending on the artist, like, you know, you listen to like, I don't know, like Coltrane, like Live in Japan record. And it's just like, he's just like in a trance. Like, it's like letting out these like sheets of sound, like just craziest lines ever. And they're like, it's like beautiful, but it's also just like dissonant and like tortured, and it just sounds like he's fucking letting the demons out. I don't know how that's supposed to make me feel. Like, I can't put an exact word on it. And that's like another really cool thing about music, is it can almost like, it's a universal language that like transcends language and even like human emotion sometimes, in terms of like how we can even describe it, which is, I think, just so powerful.
So I actually think that lyrics cheapen it sometimes.
If the lyrics aren't good, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, even if they are good, well, I don't know. I love lyrics, but it's weird because like when you're listening to lyrics, you're basically being told what it is, right? So that is what the song is to some degree. So comes to mind right now is like the fourth movement of like Schubert's Ninth, or the opening to Brahms's First Symphony. Like, there's some moments that are just so like beyond words that if you put words to it, it would water it down. And a perfect example actually is German Requiem by Brahms, which is a choral piece. There was a conductor in Atlanta, not my dad, who basically translated the German choral score into English. And so I heard it performed in English, now knowing what they're saying, and it kind of just killed it for me, because now it's what it's about for them, as opposed to my just like I guess subconscious reaction to the music, or I don't know what the right word is, like struggling for a word, because like you're trying to describe something that's beyond words,
right?
So it's hard to come up with a word for it. But so that's why I just say understanding what they were saying killed it for me.
Well, I don't know the exact piece you're referencing, but it also might come down to the fact that like in the Germanic, you know, language, there's so many, they have so many words, and they can mean like very, very specific things. So who knows? Like, I'm sure the translation was just fine, but maybe there was something that was lost in translation a little bit, or
it was a little weird. Oh, here's a perfect example from modern music. Dimmu Borgir, when they released the Norwegian versions of some of their songs, I actually like those better,
right?
Because I can't understand a word. So it's all just the feeling.
Right.
Like, I love those songs in English too.
Right.
I love everything by them. But like the Norwegian version of the songs, I like better. Or I believe Opeth also did a Swedish version of something. And I remember hearing it and was like, this is fucking cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Fucking cool, because I don't know what he's saying. So it's like pure music at that point.
Yeah.
Which I think is great.
I think that's probably why maybe in some ways I was drawn to death metal, because I mean there's some guys where you can make out what they're saying because they enunciate really well, but I mean, yeah, a lot of death metal, even like some of my favorite shit, like I might know the song title, or I might know like a specific thing that he says here or there, but like for the most part, like even still, I have no fucking idea like what a lot of my favorite bands are, you know, singing about. Or maybe I read the lyrics like when I was a kid and then just kind of forgot, so I might have a gist of it, right? But yeah, that's the kind of the cool thing about death metal, is it's just this like pure unbridled brutality capturing that very real emotion. But yeah, having no idea, I mean, you know that it's brutal and that it's heavy and that they're probably not singing about polka dots and moonbeams or whatever, but at the same time, it's like
they may as well be,
right? They might as well be. Yeah.
that's why I think that joke metal projects will, and I'm not really into joke metal projects, but that's why joke metal projects tend to be like that idea, like something silly in the content of the lyrics over super brutal music and vocals because of the contrast.
Yeah.
Or like a, you know, a dog barking it or a parrot. Actually, I like that.
Yeah, hate beak.
I like that. I thought that was well done. So let's talk about Jens and the mix. You know, I'm getting ready to go to Sweden in like 2 weeks to attend the end of the Jens Doth mix. And I remember when I first heard some of your new material, I was like, damn, this sounds really good. Why? Not like your other stuff doesn't sound really good. But it just had a certain something to it.
Uh-huh.
And then I found out Jens did it. I was like, oh, okay, that's it. So I was wondering, what was your experience like working with him?
We never interfaced at all. I don't think we even had like a phone call conversation. It was just like, hey, are you available? Like, I gave him some notes in terms of like, hey, I love what you did on these Opeth records. I love how kind of organic it feels, and it's death metal with a lot of dynamics, right? It's like, you know, it almost sounds like a perfect merger of like hard rock production with death metal vibes to it. And then I gave him like a classic straight up death metal record, Bloodbath, Nightmares Made Flesh, which he did. I'm like, can you just sort of take those two kind of vibes and merge them together? Because in a lot of ways, Nether Heaven is sort of an homage to diabolical death metal bands I grew up listening to, and me kind of like tipping my hat to those bands and that subject matter that is just so iconic to the genre that we play. But I also wanted to have, you know, that modern punch to it as well. So that I think some of those like Opeth records have, where it's like it's organic, but it has like a nice, you know, modern kind of crispness to it without it ever sounding sterile. Like that was like a big thing. I was like, we definitely don't want this to be like, you know, quantized or like any shit like that. Like we went into the studio, like we got the takes that we wanted to get. And like, how can you just make it sound like three guys like in a room rocking the fuck out? And I think, yep, Jens did a great job of that. It was kind of like a no news is good news situation in terms of like, cause I tracked my vocal parts, and or I should say I engineered my, you know, my guitar playing and my vocals, and Brett laid his tracks down and I engineered his bass playing. We did go to Brick Hit House and we did the drums with Shane Frisbee, because fuck that, I'm not recording drums and I don't have the gear or the know-how or the space or any of that.
Yeah, let someone who does that do that.
Right. But all the other stuff I did myself, and I kind of took on that producer role. So when I sent him off the tracks, it was kind of like, I mean, I knew on my end, like everything was sounding good, but it was a little bit of like a fingers crossed, like, because yeah, you never know, like you get it back and it's like, oh, the levels on this or, you know, whatever, you recorded it with, you know, in the wrong way or so. Like, I was really hoping like we weren't going to hear any complaints. And yeah, everything looked good to him. Everything sounded good. You know, we didn't go back and forth too much. It was probably like a couple weeks on the mix, maybe three at most, and he would kind of give us like one song at a time, and then we would kind of move on from there. So that was maybe a little bit different than the past, where I think we usually get like the full record mixed. This was like he was kind of just sort of drop one at a time, but we spent a good amount of time on the guitar tone. I sent him just the DI tracks. I mean, I was using a plug-in tone, but I basically told him like, hey, you know, experiment with some different heads. Like, I think you know the vibe that we're going for, but give me a few different options. And I think we ended up settling on, it was one amp and cab in one ear, and then we did like another complimentary guitar sound in the other ear, which is always fun. Like, I think it's cool, like when you can get like two kind of different guitar sounds that like blend well together, that like, kind of add up more than like more the sum of their parts type of thing.
It's rare, and it's not rare. It's actually just difficult to pull off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for whatever reason, like
phase mainly.
Right. It just, I don't know. Like, I think I heard one tone. I'm like, I like this about this tone, and these other things that maybe I feel like this tone is lacking. I'm hearing more in that tone, so let's just try it and see how it sounds. And I was like, oh shit, this actually sounds fucking killer. Yeah, I think the drums sound great. I think, however, he EQ'd my vocals sounds awesome. Just the whole mix was great. Of course, it would have been cool to like be there like in the studio like while he's mixing it like in real time, or like at least have like a day or two to like check it out. and shoot the shit, because obviously when someone's mixing something, there's a little bit of like a intimacy there, right? I mean, like they're all like, I know like when Mastodon talk about it, like they talk about like it's a fifth member, like whoever is like coming in yeah. to like produce it is like they really consider that person.
I mean, they are putting their stamp on your music,
right?
Whatever they say, like, and come on your own podcast and say that it's all about the artist all day long, but you're putting it through their brain, their ears, their tendencies,
right.
Like it's going to be theirs. Yep. Too.
And if anything, it's almost like their name might be on the line more so than the band's reputation in some ways, right? Because they can kind of get blamed for it either way. So if the songs are great and the mix sounds like shit, they're like, people are being like, oh, like this guy like ruined the Revocation sound or whatever, right? And then like if the songs aren't good but the mix is great, like almost like they could still get blamed for it. Like, oh, they changed up producers and this is the result they got, like, you know, because some people, I think they might not, you know, be as aware of just different things, and you can kind of like, you can easily kind of cast blame on different parties if you wanted to. So it certainly is like their name is on the line, their seal of approval is on every single mix that they do. And, you know, in this business, right, like we're putting out a record like every few years, right? But if we put out like a shitty record, like, I mean, we really got to come out the gate like next record with the banger, because like otherwise like you get written up, because it's like you're kind of like only as good as the last thing that you've done, right? But with
yep.
a producer, I mean, yeah, you might be working on 20, 30 records a year. And like each one has to be good, because if you lose focus even on one because you were backed up or working on a bunch of different projects, like again, people are going to be like, oh, that last mix that so-and-so did sucked, and now all of a sudden you're a shitty producer.
You know what sucks for mixers too is these days, and I'm sure you did a fine job, but these days, you know, with musicians self-recording so much, there's a wide spectrum of the quality level that a mixer is dealing with. The most successful mixers are dealing with this. This is not just a local level thing. Like big time heavy music mixers are getting tracks sent to them by bands that are recorded like total dog shit. And lots of times some mixer's record that doesn't sound that great is actually a miracle that it sounds as good as it does. Like it could have been a total F,
right?
And they brought it up to a C+,
right? Right.
Which is a miracle,
right?
As opposed to getting handed an A- and taking it to A+ or a B+, taking it to A. That's way less of a miracle than taking an F to a C+. But people hear that C+ as compared to all their other A level work, and they're like, God, what were they? Were they on drugs or something?
Right, right,
or
right.
Were they dealing with a divorce? Or
right, like, right. No, yeah, they don't know what the raw materials were like. And then sometimes people get, you know, too attached to guitar tones or whatever. Like maybe, you know, they're using some shitty plug-in sound, but they just kind of get used to it. And then when they hear it reamped with like an actual good tone, they can't get the old shit. You know, because sometimes there is that kind of demo-itis thing that happens where people sort of get used to the sound of the demo after a while, and then you know, someone with fresh ears listens to it and makes the adjustments that need to be made, but you're like, you get married to the rough mix or whatever, and all of a sudden it starts to sound weird to you.
It's weird though. Have you ever had it happen where something is legitimately better on the demo? Because I have. So that's what makes it harder, is because sometimes it actually has been better. It's some of these like weird lead or clean, like these like parts that are very tough to recreate. It's never like rhythm guitars or something. It's always like some like weird part that like is like the sound you got is part of how you wrote it.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's funny. There's actually a part on the new record that I recorded. I wouldn't even call it a demo. Like it was like, I was fucking around with this weird loop kind of thing. It was actually like loosely inspired by this Joe Henderson like Latin tune called like Recordame. Like you'd never, because I just used like a small piece of it and then like did it in my own way and then like added weird harmonies to it. You'd never know that it was from that, but I remember just kind of fucking around with this like little idea and being like, oh, what if this was like more metal? And I remember I had it like in my like Ditto looper, like when I was just like layering like harmonies on to it like for the first time. And I'm like, I think I actually took like the out from the looper and like put it into my interface and recorded like that. So it wasn't like three separate guitar tracks.
Yeah.
In Logic, it was just printed as one thing. I was like, like legitimately thinking like, should I just like put this on the record? Cause it just had this weird sound to it.
Why not?
But I ended up re-recording it and it still sounds cool, but there was some element of like, it had this like kind of like shitty, like degraded quality to it.
So that's my question is why not? Like why did you make that decision?
I think first of all, it was like a tempo thing too. Like it wasn't quite the right tempo that I started at.
Okay.
And I did want to have it separated out a little bit more rather than sort of printed on one track. I think it was like the way it comes in.
So it wasn't quite there for you.
Parts of it weren't quite there, but there was other parts that were, and it was just one of those things where I guess, I had to like make that artistic decision to be like, all right,
it's a tough one.
Yeah, it is. It is. But also probably you put like 10 people with fresh ears listening to it, they're probably going to be like, the way it sounds on recording, like on the record is definitely better than this. But it was just like, it was one of those things where I had it for like so long and I had listened to it like a bunch of times where there was just some weird magic to it for me. But sometimes that shit, you have to kind of check yourself and be like, is this purely nostalgia, right? Is it, or some kind of offshoot of that, right? Where it's like, do I like this because it legitimately does sound better, or have I just like literally heard it so many times?
It's a tough question. I remember on the Concealers album, Sukhov used a lot of my pre-pro on the cleans and like weird guitar parts, which I was really happy about because there was no way we could have, like, maybe we could have gotten it more pristine, sure, but like some of those parts that just sound like dark and shitty but cool,
right?
Like they're straight from the pre-pro and we just couldn't recreate them, and it was like, why? All I had is an stereo MP3 of it, and he's like, fuck, just import it.
Yeah.
Can you tell the difference? Can you tell it's an MP3? No.
Right.
Like, okay, so who fucking cares?
Yeah, yeah. There's sometimes some of the magic, you know, can get lost, right? When you try to over sterilize things, and I think that's why some of those early recordings have such a great feel to them, because there's I'm sure you go in and like isolate different takes of some of your favorite records, and then you're just listening to the guitar and it's like, oh, he like, you know, fucked up that one part, but it sounds super cool in the mix, or it's played like a little bit sloppy, but it's got like attitude.
I remember hearing some Muse tracks. Someone who worked on it sent me some stems a while ago for some of their big songs from the 2000s, like their rock songs that I love, and listening and being like, man, like this is sloppier than I thought, which makes it even cooler.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like sloppy or anything. It was still sick, but like, you know, he will like tremolo on his solos sometimes. And it wasn't like perfect 16th notes the entire time, like you would expect from a metal player. Like it was wild, but in the best possible way. And I was thinking, it had a vibe and it made it to this. So on the record, these songs are huge. And it just that, and I remember getting those stems so long before Nail the Mix. Like this is like getting sent them in like 2009 or 2010. And that kind of like, it like flipped a switch in my mind. It was like, all right, so I love Muse. These songs are huge. They're great. You can't hear these little blips in the mix. It's not like they put out something where you can hear a blip, but like what they did capture is a feeling. Like you can hear the feeling in all those takes. It seems to me like they prioritized capturing atmosphere, feeling, vibe, expression, and it kind of just flipped my switch on what priorities should be versus what they are sometimes in the studio. That's not to say that there aren't certain things that should be dead the fuck on, but when people try to make everything dead the fuck on, I think it doesn't usually lead to great results.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that's sort of a symptom of like certain bands in modern metal where they try to make everything too too perfect, like overly quantized or overly gridded out, or it starts to almost sound like it's not even a guitar anymore when the parts are so edited. Like, you know, you listen back to it and you're like, oh, that's technically like perfect, but like all like the soul of it was like taken out, right? Like it sounds almost like a MIDI guitar or something like that. It doesn't feel like someone like played it in a real way. Like some of those like slight intricacies of like slop is probably the wrong word, but like, you know, just a little bit of extra gunk here and there, humanity, right?
Slop is the wrong word because...
But sometimes slop's a vibe. I don't know. Sometimes there's just a fucking vibe when the picking is just like, you know, a little bit shitty, or like it's not like perfectly pristine, but the tone was cool, or the way someone like slid into the note was a little bit, you know, not perfect, but it just adds like humanity, to the music. And like, especially with going back to like those classic records, like there's like those, sometimes those like happy accidents that come into play because people weren't overly analyzing every little thing, and they were probably, you know, just these young kids like in the studio like recording shit, and they were probably on a budget and they like kind of had to make it work. Like I think a classic example of that to me, which is one of the most like iconic riffs of all time, is on the on Slayer's, like that, the breakdown to was it Angel of Death, like when it goes into that, like that little breakdown section in the bridge there. The guitar, now I can't say for sure, and it's one of those like mysteries. I would love to like pick like Kerry King's brain about it or something, but like on the recording, when they go into the harmony, I mean, you know the riff I'm talking about, right? It's very spider fingery, and it just has those weird chromatic trills, and then he goes into that weird chord, like with just like all these like sneaky chromatic walk-ups. When they do the harmony, it's perfect fifths, okay? Except at the very, very tail end of the riff, it goes to a tritone harmony. And as you know from recording, like tritone harmonies are just like
they're tough.
They're weird. And I mean, it's almost like a minor second like harmony or something like that, right? It just sounds really like strange. I mean, you can get evil sounding harmonies by doing things in like just minor thirds or something like that. Like no matter what the riff is, it's a minor third. And that will just naturally sound evil. Or you could do major thirds, or you could do like fifths and keep it all like one, like non-diatonic, but keeping the same parallel intervals, right? If we're talking about like counterpoint, like doing like, you know, parallel motion. So to throw that like tritone in at the end just like adds just another level of just like Satan to the riff, to an already very like diabolical sounding riff. However, when Kerry King teaches that riff, there's been several videos of him teaching that, like that you can find on like YouTube. He moves up on record. I don't know if he's playing the high part or the low part. When he's teaching the riff, he's playing the lower part of the harmony. On the record, he moves up, or whoever moves up a minor third. And when Kerry King teaches it, he moves up a whole step. And assuming the higher harmony is the same, then it's totally parallel. Perfect fifths.
Yep.
So like his way of teaching it, whether maybe he plays it live that way, it becomes perfect fifths all the way through. So I can't say for sure if they did it in the studio and they made a quote unquote like mistake, but you know, that no one even, they're listening to the whole record and they're not thinking about the minutiae of that.
That is probably it. That's probably it.
Or maybe over time playing it so many times, they just naturally decided to like morph that part a little bit and do something a little bit different live, but it seems so like such a small inconsequential thing that like it just seems like a very like weird thing to change just for that one part. So you know, was the mistake on the recording or did it evolve? Anyway, it's just one of those like weird like heavy metal mysteries out there. I mean, this is like music nerd shit, right? Like
no, but man, that stuff matters. Like I remember just recently, one of the things that I discovered, I played one note on one super intricate part a half step off. Like I don't know how I missed it on the recording, but I discovered it when I went home to review it. I was like, how the fuck did this happen?
Right.
And it's like this one note out of a flurry of notes that I went and I fixed it. I feel like in earlier days where you didn't have quite the same monitoring situation, stuff like that would just slip the cracks.
And no one would be the wiser either.
Yeah, no one would know. I didn't know till you just told me.
Right. It's just one of those like little Easter eggs. But there is a magic to that riff. I think. Yeah, I think maybe part of it what might have been that if we're calling it a quote unquote mistake, right? Like maybe the magic in that part was the mistake. You know, the fact that like they were just doing it live and someone moved up the wrong amount of half steps on the fretboard, wrong quote unquote, right? Or who knows? Maybe it was a very calculated thing, but then they changed their minds later on. My gut feeling is it was just like. I really can't say. I don't know if they changed it live later or if they kept it that way, but it certainly is like a wild card to throw in there to keep everything perfect fifths and then just right at the end change it.
They probably wrote it the way he teaches it, and the take is just the take
right.
in the recording because they had, who knows, they probably had like a week or something
right.
to do that. Just a guess.
Super fascinating. And I've heard things like that on some of my own recordings where you're going back and listening to things like whether it's like a solo or something and like, you know, like with the Sheet Happens tab books. Like, I mean, I'm really meticulous with going through and make sure like every single note is like dead on. And yeah, sometimes I'll like hear a part and I'm like, oh, that's weird. Like in that run there, I hit like a wrong note or whatever. I mean, sometimes I'm intentionally being chromatic, and when I'm doing that, like I know what I'm doing, right? Or I'm doing weird triad pairing, or I know when I'm taking it outside. But there are those other elements where I'm like, oh, I thought for sure when I did this lick here, it was like,
yep,
I was hitting these notes in this scale, but for whatever reason, it just kind of slipped out of that pattern and went to a different thing. But it sounds cool in the record, so at that point, like, who gives a shit what scale it's in, right? If it sounds cool, it sounds cool.
So, but it is actually a mistake.
I mean, it's hard to say. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's like, yes, it was not in the scale. Maybe it wasn't something that I intended to play, but we'll call it a happy accident, I guess. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I guess not what you were intending to play, not even what you thought you played, I guess.
Right, exactly. But again, there's other points where I'm doing something chromatic or playing outside the scale, and I know exactly what I'm doing to achieve that sound. So that's different than that, because I play outside the scale like all the fucking time in my playing. It's just funny when it's one of those moments where it's like, oh, I didn't even realize I was like, went out there, but it just sounded kind of cool.
So speaking of scales, I wanted to ask you this. There was a question in the Riff Hard group earlier today, and I was like, this is actually a really good question for Dave. And this is by Tyler Simons. Any advice on connecting scales? I'm struggling finding ways to make my scale runs sound less robotic with my phrasing. How do you approach scales and what do you do to connect them? I guess I'm unclear on whether he means connecting different scales together or different positions or what, but I felt like this might be a good question to ask you.
Sure. I think you gotta look at, well, let's just say we're staying like diatonic to a key. Like let's say we're in G Ionian, right? And then there's all the different modes of G Ionian. So I would make sure that for every single mode, you have at least two ways of playing it, both from the low E string and from the A string, if we're thinking about, you know, the root, right? So if I'm thinking about playing G major, I might play it with a combination of two and three notes per string in two octaves. So if you can picture the scale on the fretboard, I'm starting on the third fret of my E string and I'm ending on the third fret of my high E string and I'm keeping it mm-hmm. very much in a position like that. Then I might play it like all three notes per string. And if I'm keeping it just strictly within the boundaries of two octaves, I would be ending on the eighth fret of my B string, right? So starting on the third fret of my low E string and ending on the eighth fret of my B string and make sure you ascend and descend those scales. So you have two ways of playing it there, and then I would play that same exact pattern from the A string. Of course, keeping it within the framework of two octaves. When I'm on the high E string, I'd have to play like four notes per string essentially to kind of finish off the octave, and then I could do it, you know, strictly with the three note per string as well. So from the low E and the A string, two different shapes of that scale, and try to have that for every single mode. And then you can just sort of essentially do exercises where you do like what would be like what's known as a flow exercise, where you essentially set a metronome and you can pick any one of those modes And even though you might be moving through different positions that might look like a Phrygian scale shape or a Lydian scale shape or a Mixolydian scale shape or whatever, but let's say I'm thinking about it like E natural minor, I would play through as low as I can go and as high as I can go. And it's okay to see the other modal scale shapes as you're moving through, just because naturally you might say, oh, this is that, I'm familiar with this shape. You know, I'm playing what might look like a Dorian, an A Dorian scale position, but I'm thinking about it like it's E natural minor. So I'm trying to maybe to make it sound more like the scale that I'm in, you might need to think about not just playing it straight up and down, but you might have to think about adding intervallic leaps in there, kind of carving out an E minor triad or an E minor seven arpeggio that kind of firmly roots that line back into the framework of the chord that you're playing over. I think the biggest issue if you're trying to sound like you're playing over changes is actually you might be thinking about it from the wrong direction. Like rather than thinking about it like from the scale, I try to think about it like what are the chord tones, right? So what is the arpeggio? So the E minor triad or the E minor seven, and then I look at kind of all the other scale tones in that scale as you know either passing tones or color tones. Depending on the scale that you're in, every single note might be like a color tone. Like, for example, like A Dorian traditionally has no avoid notes, right? Because of the way the scale is constructed. Whereas in an Ionian scale, like the perfect fourth, you don't really want to hang on that because that's going to create a clash between the major third and the fourth. There's that half step there. So you can use the fourth for sure. And you can even, you know, make melodies with the fourth. But sort of if you find yourself continuously kind of doubling down on the perfect fourth when you're playing in like Ionian, it's going to sound like you don't really know what you're doing. And that's kind of like the first thing I can hear when I'm with a student, for example, when they improvise for me, is like I can hear right away if they're just kind of like noodling through like a scale versus someone that actually knows how to like carve out a line and make a chord, like make it sound like when they're soloing over a chord change. Like you should be able to solo and I don't need to hear a backing track in the background. If you tell me you're going to play over like a blues or something like that, like I should be able to like hear, like, you know, when the four chord is coming and you know when the five chord is coming. Certainly you can kind of, you know, work your way through a blues just using like, you know, the root scale, minor pentatonic scale. And it's going to have sort of one level of, I mean, if you have good rhythm, you can make even just like a pentatonic or a blues scale sound fine. But I'm talking more about like maybe like a jazz blues with more chord changes, you know, maybe there's some like secondary dominance and like two fives and things like that that add to the harmonic complexity of a tune. Or it doesn't even have to be in the jazz realm. It could just be like two separate chords and like two separate keys. Like, okay, we're going to go from, let's say we're doing like a chromatic median thing, right? Okay, we're going to go from like an F sharp Lydian sound to a B flat Lydian sound or something like that and move back and forth between those two chords, and it's going to create this kind of ethereal dreamlike thing. I should be able to hear you like play those arpeggios and connect the dots with the chord tones, and that's going to create a stronger sound than if you're just kind of like running up and down the scale. So, you know, if you're forcing yourself only to think about the scales, at least have several positions to them and then try to do that flow exercise where you play as low as possible and as high as possible with a strict with a tempo and a subdivision and just kind of keep it going. And you maybe try to do different intervals, different melodies in there. But really, like if you're missing the chordal element, like the triadic or the seventh chord arpeggio element, like no matter how much you practice scales, your improvisation is never going to get to that next level. So work on the scales, make sure you're familiar with them. But you have to start to think about the arpeggios as well. Otherwise, it's not going to sound as good.
Great answer. Thank you. That's why when I saw that question in the group earlier, I was like, yep, bringing this to Dave. So thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, I think it's a good place to end the episode. I want to thank you for taking the time to hang out. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Pleasure's all mine.
Thank you, sir. Good luck on the tour.
Thanks, man. Yeah, can't wait.